Welcome to the Power of the Purse podcast, the only show connecting women professionals to their peers. This isn't just about money. This is about life. And now the host of the Power of the Purse podcast, Lynn S. Evans.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lynn S. Evans, and I am the host of Power of the Purse podcast. There was a time in my life not too long ago when I believed three things about money. One, women are not supposed to talk about or be included in any conversations about money. Two, women don't have the natural ability to understand anything about money. And three, men know best how to manage money. And those truths I made up about money guided me for years until I realized money was not a foreign language or some other obscure academic exercise. It was something I could not only understand, but teach to other women. And too many times I've heard stories from women who ought to know better but didn't until they were forced to because of divorce, widowhood, job loss, or the approach of retirement. This podcast will add another chapter to a rich history of successful women who, when faced with some personal challenges, found the ability to step beyond them. We'll examine some of the truths they made up about money from their life experiences and how that shaped the paths they chose. My mission is to help women have a healthy, positive relationship with money. With that in mind, my guest today is attorney Kim Manning. She is the director of legal services at UPMC Susquehanna. She has had quite an experience in law school, law firms, and before she was actually at UPMC Susquehanna, she was general counsel for Wyoming Valley Healthcare System and others in the past. So let's talk about everything that you are, everything you've done. Welcome, Kim.
Thank you. It's good to be
here. All righty. Great. I can't wait to talk about all this good stuff. So let's get started. Let's start with the fact that you are someone who, by most standards, would not have been expected to go to law school, let alone college, and then become the director of legal services of a large hospital system. So let's go back to the time when you were young and you talked about an example of how social programs to help the poor and disabled really did make a difference in your life. How did that evolve?
Well, Lynn, as you said in your introduction, my mother and father separated when I was about 10. And as indicated, the woman tends to fall on the harshest of times in those moments. So at that time, it was just my mother and I. And she hadn't worked since World War II. This is now 1970. And so, you know, we had to lose the home, all those sorts of things. So we ended up in Section 8 housing on welfare for a period of time, but certainly on food stamps for a number of years. We're on Medicaid off and on for those years. And what I discovered, other than, as my mother used to say, it's no sin to be poor, it's just damn inconvenient, was two things. One was, there was a shame projected on people, and I think there still is, for attempting to use and obtain those things, but they can make all the difference in the world because that allowed us to continue. And then as we moved further on, my parents did get back together, but my father was disabled. So at that point in time, throughout my college time, I was able to obtain Social Security disability, which helped me fund my college career. I also was entitled to various grants that unfortunately are not as available as they used to be. But even through high school, I was able, because our low income was low because of my father's disability or prior to that, their separation, my mother always made certain that we went for every opportunity that was available to us and made good use of it. So jobs programs for people in high school and certainly in college. I worked for many judicial offices when I was in college during the summer. Certainly the various health care options. We didn't, you know, if I needed to see a doctor, I saw a doctor. The same way with the housing. My mother became very good at finding ways to find exactly what talk landlords into using, becoming Section 8 landlords and taking in those tenants and doing away with some of the false or certainly negative narratives that are applied to all recipients of those types of things, and teach them that we could be excellent tenants and maintain the property and excellent neighbors, as well as certainly with the medical stuff. She learned how to talk about some of the older requirements that made hospitals provide free care at times when we had no insurance. She would remind hospitals of their Hill-Burton obligations, and it allowed me to have some necessary surgery that, had I not had, my hand would be disfigured. So I think it's important to realize, A, I am grateful for all those services. That's the first thing I'm going to say, and I appreciate all the tax dollars that went into it. But I, like many, many other people, used those to change my life so that I was able to reach my dream. I was able to go to college. My parents had gone to college, but I was able to complete college. And then I worked full time and went to law school at night, and I was able to complete that and fulfill my dream. So never assume that money going to these social programs is going for only those who are using and are lazy and are not fulfilling the promise that these programs offer.
That's a great story. It really is. But I'm wondering, when I also realized that you said that you were lucky enough to be doing what you hoped you would be doing from the age of 10 on, did that coincide with your parents' separation, that you decided at that point you wanted to become an attorney? Or were they two irrelevant things?
No, they were very much relevant. The selection of attorney, unfortunately, I have to say, probably had more to do with television and the portrayals of various lawyers that I thought looked like a good, seemed to be an honorable thing to do. And they were more, and I was, have never been a math and science genius, but more importantly, what I saw, I mean, my mother did her best, but again, she had not worked in 30 years when we hit this problem. And what I felt very strongly was, again, no respect, disrespect to her, that both parents should be equally capable of stepping into the role of wage owner to take care of their children. I felt that very strongly, and to financially support them. And that I looked at that age, what professions could you do that would allow you some flexibility to come in and out, and even work well beyond the normal 60, 65. What could you do even on your own to earn money to support your family? That was, and it turned out, in my view, was the professions. And again, since I was no whiz with numbers, I didn't see accounting or medicine an option. So I liked the law, and that's where I went from.
And did you have any siblings later when your parents got back together?
No, actually, everybody is older than me. So my oldest sister is 20 years older, and she married rather young, and we go, there's five of us. So the nearest sibling to me is 5 years older than me, but she was out of the house living with my oldest sibling when my parents, actually, she lived with my father for a while, and then she lived with my oldest sibling. And then everybody was in college or post-college and working by the time that sort of went down.
So did all your siblings avail themselves of some of that government programs? You said they were all educated and out of the house before that happened?
Well, so my oldest sister didn't get an education until much later in life, actually until after she divorced. I would say my brother was the first to go to college. He certainly had, now certainly my father was a baker and a candy maker, and he had a normal working class income. There was always, living paycheck to paycheck and bills to worry about. So I wouldn't say there was money to educate each of us. So we certainly learned to take advantage of grants and scholarships, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I would say the sister closest in age to me probably had a similar experience. Well, actually, I take that back. All of them probably had some experience in taking advantage of programs for summer jobs in high school and in college to lower income individuals. And all of those relationships yielded either a connection or a mentor or something that allowed them to take the next step.
Was there ever a time on that path between the time you had the dream of wanting to be an attorney and when you actually got into law school that you had any second doubts or second thoughts about doing this?
Yes, and I would say towards the end of my college career, I did. And I had a cousin who was married to a judge who wisely made the suggestion that for me to take a few years off and go to work for a law firm as a paralegal and see if you like it. And that was an excellent suggestion. At that point in time, paralegals did not require a BA. There wasn't even a certification for paralegals in the early 80s. So I just went with my bachelor's degree and an interest and started applying for jobs and was able to get one pretty quickly with Dickey, McCamey, and Chilcote in Pittsburgh. And I did that for 2 years and realized actually there were some law students who were acting as messengers who kept saying, you really need to take the next step. You really need to apply and go to the next step and go into school.
And where did you go to school?
I went to Duquesne University in Pittsburgh at night, and I worked full-time at Dickey McCamey during the day.
Okay. So once you got that, it passed the bar, you became a full-fledged attorney. Did you find that it was what you expected it to be? Did it live up to your dream?
It did and it didn't. At that point in time, we were just starting to get into the world of the importance of billable hours, et cetera, over necessarily the quality. I mean, quality was still important, but billable hours was becoming a thing. Interestingly enough, I started working in Savannah, Georgia, where that was my first job. And the lawyer couple of the lawyers knew me from my paralegal years because they did similar work to what I was doing in Pittsburgh. So they knew of me. And their largest client at that law firm, Hunter McLean, Exley & Dunn, was Memorial Medical Center in Savannah, Georgia. And a few years before I started practicing law, they had taken the opportunity, instead of when the hospital was making noises about hiring in-house counsel, they said, I'll tell you what, you can rent an in-house counsel from this firm. All you have to do is cover their salary and expenses. It'll be, you know, less expensive than billable hours. And they'll have the access to the firm and all, you know, but they'll still be on our pension plan, et cetera. And they did that. But the first two lawyers they sent out had been longtime lawyers, really bordering on, if not already, partners. And it was a very different environment to walk into in-house counsel position, which is really much more seat of your pants, a lot less research and time and very thorough writing. A lot of in-houses kind of get me the answer, get it quickly, and, you know, figure out the problem. So anyway, one day, Malcolm McLean walked in my office and said, we need another sacrificial lamb on the high altar of the hospital, and you're it. You start Monday.
That's great.
So I started, where I think some may have thought that I would hate it, I loved it to the point where I didn't want to come back. And eventually the hospital hired me to run their risk management program away from the from the law firm. But that was that's how I got started working in healthcare. Before that, I was doing asbestos litigation.
Mm-hmm. And so then how did all this bring you to UPMC Susquehanna?
Well,
Were you still in Pittsburgh?
No, so that was Savannah, right? At a certain point in time, Savannah, at that point in time, this would be the mid-90s, was a lovely place to visit, but not necessarily a great place to live. Very high murder rate, very high pollution rate. And there was a great deal of inequality and segregation along racial lines that I was always raised to believe the worst thing you can be in this world is a racist. So it was at times a difficult place for me to live. So I had been licensed both in Georgia and Pennsylvania. I took a second bar exam in Pennsylvania after I had my Georgia license and got that. So after about 6 years in Georgia, I decided to move back to Pennsylvania. I was actually recruited then to go to Wyoming Valley in Wilkes-Barre.
Okay.
And from there, within a few months, I was put on a blind date and met my husband, and and then life starts. UPMC about a year and 3 months ago acquired Susquehanna Health System So I had been working for Susquehanna Health System for about 11 years now, 12 years. They had been a client. For a while, I was working at Stevens and Lee after Wyoming Valley, after my son was born, just part-time because I needed some extra flexibility, hence that 10-year-old thought that you could have some flexibility mm-hmm. in a profession. And but when he started school, I knew I was ready to go full-time, and this opportunity opened up at Susquehanna Health, and I took it. And then, like I said, UPMC purchased Susquehanna Health System about a little bit more than a year ago.
Okay. So this is the perfect segue. Let's talk about your son, because I know this is a really important and significant life event for you. So you were married at that time. Yes. Was your husband an attorney as well?
No. At that point in time, my husband was working for Merck in Danville, and he uh-huh. was a licensed waste treatment operator. He has since gone on, actually, Merck has 18 months paternity leave available to them, as well as maternity, and he's the first one to ever actually take paternity leave, let alone the full 18 months. But he used it to do all the coursework and study and pass all his licensures for insurance, stockbroker, and then his financial planner advisor certification. Mm-hmm. So he transitioned into that role. So, but yes, so my son was born 2 years after we were married, and he was born 3 months premature. So he was in a NICU, and with all the health complications that come with that, he was in the NICU in Allentown, and I was still working up in Wilkes-Barre. So I would drive for 4 months he was in NICU, and I would drive back and forth. But he also, the prematurity had multiple health issues. But we found at that time he was also born with a neurological birth defect called a disorder of the corpus callosum. In his case, you have some disagreement, frankly, amongst the neurologists, but his is very thin. So corpus callosum is about 200 million basic nerves that go between the left side of your brain and your right side of your brain, and allows you to do everything from go left, right when you walk to remember what time your lunch date is. It's the main source of communication and body function. Without it, in his case, it's sometimes the brain can rewire, but in his case, because it's thin, the brain is constantly trying to send information what should be across a 15-lane superhighway that it's trying to go across a 2-lane bridge. So it gets so it's resulted in a lot of developmental delay. He is nonverbal. He also has a seizure disorder. And he probably functions, you know, young grade school level at the age of 19.
So that had to be a major blow to you in the sense that the big question was, well, what do I do? How do I live my life? How does my husband get involved in all this? How do we make this work? So how did you put all that together? Did you have any resources that helped?
I had an amazing group of NICU doctors and nurses. And because we were there for 4 months, we became friends, and they did give us some wealth of experience. But this is really before the internet. And certainly before things like listservs and things like that. And we actually had a pediatric neurologist who said, whatever you do, stay off the internet, because only the worst case scenarios are there. So there really wasn't. There wasn't much at that point in time other than sort of the other parents. And we had no basis of knowledge in our family. I did as much research as I could. It helped at that time that I was part of Wyoming Valley, because God bless them, the librarian for the medical library sent me as much medical information and as much information that he had access to. I did become aware of a parents group involved in this disorders of the corpus callosum. It was a couple out of Maine who at that time I had email at work, and so they had started a listserv. And they were two professors out of the University of Maine who had a son with this disorder, and just started adding parents, just supporting each other. And then from that, it grew into an organization called the National Organization of Disorders of the Corpus Callosum. But at that time, as far as a personal decision, especially fiscally, you know, one of the things we did is we allowed my husband to take that 18 months. We knew he was doing 7-day swing shift at Merck, and that couldn't work very well and balance potentially what was going to happen. So he needed to shift into something that was a more professional and had a little bit more flexibility of hours. So he used that time to gain those certifications so he could transition his work. I knew from going back and forth to the NICU an hour's drive after work that, and shortly even after he came home, that the needs of trying to order supplies, he was on lots of different equipment, oxygen, feeding tubes, lots of different stuff, that it really required it required enough of my time that I couldn't devote the time and effort that I needed into being the position that I had, which was general counsel at Wyoming Valley at the time. So I made a decision to not step away, but to step back into a part-time position with a law firm to give me some added flexibility to make a, physician appointments, make all these arrangements. Sort of, it's an incredible orchestration of people and in addition to the care, it's people, it's, God help me, the volumes and reams of insurance stuff and materials, et cetera, that has to be gone through. But I also made a conscious decision not to continue my work, because I knew that my personality was such that if I stayed home with him full time, my type A, I need to fix this, I take a problem, I fix it, I move on. And his was not something that I could fix, his issue.
Yeah.
But I felt, having seen a lot of women fall into this, particularly professional women, that I thought it would be bad for my mental health and bad for my relationship with my son if I took on his care full time, because I knew I wouldn't be able to fix him, and I knew that would frustrate me, and I knew I needed to be able to sort of shut a little bit of that down, that frustration down, and work on something that I could have success in that also allowed me some financial stability and insurance stability to allow him to access everything he needed. Again, I needed to know that both parents could take care of this child fit financially as well as personally at any given time. And so my husband's changes and my changes allowed us to do that.
And that's really profound. And I mean that sincerely. That's not hyperbolic when I say it, but for you to actually acknowledge that your personality is such that you finally recognized, and it was one of those hello moments, that you can't fix him, and that your personality is such that you function better as a human being if you can address some things where you can fix them, and then give him the time that you want to be with him and not feel that same urge to fix him. That is really an amazing place to be for so many people who have special needs children or who are caregivers of any sort, because there's only so much, and I say this from my own personal experience, there's only so much you can do, and having that acknowledgement that I can't fix this is really an amazing lift to the spirit, to acknowledge it, just say, I can't fix this, and be okay with it, is an incredible insight that you've had. So I so acknowledge you for that and for saying, I recognize my personality is this way, and this is what I need to do, and not feel guilty. I think it's great. I just wanted to say kudos to you.
Thank you. Thank you. Obviously I want to help him, and I,
sure,
I feel certainly my negotiation skills and my understanding of regulatory matters have helped me more than others. For example, be sympathetic to the school district when they're trying to go through their regulatory hoops of the federal government and to negotiate the insurance issues. I needed to have those skills that allowed us, whether we were doing an appeal or something like that. But I also needed to know when to back off, because sometimes you can be a little bit too ferocious in these things. You need to hear what the other side is saying and come to the right conclusion, even if it's walking away from a provider or a school situation that doesn't fit you, but do so without a level of emotion as they're out to get me, they don't understand, yeah, as opposed to just acknowledging it's just not the right fit. For the circumstances. So, I'll continue to have that journey. I mean, he switched from being a child to an adult the past 2 years, and it's been an interesting journey just even getting him switched over from the pediatric community to the adult community, because you find fewer and fewer providers willing to take care of adults with intellectual disabilities and autism, and fewer programs. For everybody who complains about special education in the school district, they need to see what happens when they turn 21 in that school. All those lovely people in that school district go away. I commute 80 miles a day, so he can be in what we determined was the best school district in this region for special education. And I do it gladly and willingly, but I wasn't going to move to put him in the wrong school system. So it's not that I don't make choices that are good for him, but I have to make wise choices. I took the right job for me that fulfills me and makes me happy and provides financial stability and good benefits to my whole family. But I can leave him in what has been an excellent environment for him in the Hazleton School District.
Hazleton?
Yes, Hazleton Area School District actually has one of the best. I think to a certain extent, the influx of folks from outside of the area has been a godsend, but they've just always been known for having a very good special education program. And not isolating. He's definitely always been included in things. He goes to the choral group. He's learning how to run a coffee cart. He got the award for the highest grade in geography a few years ago. He still goes to civics classes. And what every one of those teachers will tell you, those typical teachers will tell you, that they and their students gain a great deal by having Will present and hit their classroom.
Yeah, so that's great. Yeah. I didn't know if he was mobile or not, but apparently he is.
Is he in a wheelchair? He's with a nurse. No, he's not. He's a little bit awkward in his movement, but no, he's not.
Yeah,
he's completely mobile. That's not a problem.
Okay, that's great. So he's 19 now.
Right.
Okay, so what happens then? How long can he stay in school?
Till the end of the school year in which he turns 21. So it'll about 2 years.
And
so
then what happens?
So that's what we're exploring now. I know I don't want him in an adult daycare setting, and the state has been in a series of flux. There used to be these workshops, and there's a lot of different thoughts on them, but they were supervised workshops. Everybody worked, but they weren't paid very much, less than minimum wage. And again, you have this issue of, well, then it's pretty isolating. I am looking at a program that offer either supervised work in the community or a program in Williamsport in particular called Hope Enterprises offers that, where they take them into the community and they have supervisors at work. For example, at the hospital, they're at central supply sorting things. They also have a program where you're on site at their campus and they have classes and music and they have exercise things. And then you work, they have projects, legitimate projects where they pay them minimum wage and they're, you know, come from various companies all around the United States. And you might be counting paper plates and putting them in a bag, or you might be gluing things onto mats that will actually go into the space program. If you can work 2 hours at that, that's great. If you can work 4 hours at that, that's great. And they also have social events and things like that. So, it's a learning experience now too, with a little bit of concern because of some of the things that are happening on politically. Where will Medicaid be? Where will Medicare be? Where will these funding for these programs be? Pennsylvania hasn't funded waivers in many years, so you're sort of navigating that as well.
How do you keep up with all that and have a full time job?
I try. I rely on, aggregation of data. Again, now the internet, I do rely on heavily and, listservs and different organizations and Pennsylvania Bar Association actually does a special education CLE that the parents of children with disabilities are always invited to. When he was earlier in his school career, I went to those, and now I just try the best I can to keep up. But again, I cannot be so obsessed that has to be the be-all, end-all. A lot of it is feeling and looking and seeing and reviewing and talking to other parents about what works and what doesn't work, with the realization that because it worked with one family, you know, may not work with us. Not all special needs parents have things in common, but we're not all the same. So, you know, it has to work with, you know, my husband will retire soon. What does that mean? Where do we want to live? I'll retire in 10 years. What does that mean? What does this look like? So it's, you know, as any other thing, it's a complex series. It's a complex puzzle that we'll have to figure out.
Well, it sounds to me like you're really navigating this difficult road very well. I mean, in the sense that you're not just letting it happen. You're actually making things happen, so that you're directing your life and his. And I think that's just such a wonderful, inspirational thing to hear, because I think so many people just kind of give up and say, he is what he is. You know, they move him from institution to institution, and almost to the point of just not wanting to acknowledge that he's part of your life. And I love hearing about the fact that he's integrated into classrooms, not for special needs children necessarily, but I think that's great. And I think it's really, as I said before, kudos to you and your husband for navigating this and making his life rich as well as your own. So thank you for setting an example. It's great.
Thank you.
Let me go back and ask a question here about, I'm just curious of how your thoughts and beliefs about money developed. And I'm sure you had a lot that you questioned when you were going through this process, because you didn't have it. Like you said, your mom gave you some great advice. And I love the fact that she was such an advocate for knowing what was out there and how to use it, and was not in any way ashamed to say, this is out there, we need this, and you will provide it. And I think that, more than anything, her being an advocate as strongly as she was probably helped you in your advocacy for your son and for your career as being an advocate for your clients or for a cause. She was a tremendous role model for you. And I didn't know that, but I think that's really neat.
And not only that, but she also gave me a sense of style in how to do that. So, when I say that, I mean, again, my parents were, my father, when they were in my early years, was a, you know, baker and a candy maker, and, you know, but they lived definitely paycheck to paycheck. And, you know, so sometimes you would have a bill collector call, or then when we were alone, she would be trying to get something set up for us with no money. And one of the things that she would always do is, it's an interesting, she would come off as confident, but not, I'm going to come across this desk and you better, and choke the life out of you to get it. So there, but she also, she would be very, my mother would also come from a very working class background, but she would suddenly, her voice would even change. She would suddenly get very dignified with people, either in person or over the phone. And her voice would get deeper and calmer and be sort of this level of sophistication, or I am worthy, and a great deal of dignity. And she, and for example, when we went to the Medicaid clinic back in the day, if you were at Medicaid, you went to a clinic and you sat on these chairs, and she would dress me up in my best clothes as she would be. And you had to sit a certain way, and she felt that people treated you differently, and they did. There's no two ways about it. Now, I will also tell, you know, and she used to, I, you know, you may want to cut, you may not like this, but she even called it a character. She would say, I had to put on my Mrs. Gachet voice. And she would be very formal in her Mrs. Gachet. Yes, Mrs. Gachet. Yes, thank you. And she would, you know, play this whole thing, but it worked like a charm because people weren't angry with her and they couldn't be angry with her. And she didn't look down on them, but it was a very calm. But, you know, the reality was also, I'm not going to overlook the fact that I'm sure the fact that I was a pretty blonde white girl was a little bit different than the nice little black children next to me. I think that there was an element of that, even in my, whether it be the Medicaid clinic or even in the job interviews, as far as the, some of the, you know, I wouldn't say that that didn't have a little bit of an advantage, but my mother's attitude, and I can still do it to this day. Mm-hmm. It's not, I don't use the name Mrs. Gachet by any means, but it's just a way of, you know, if you slow yourself down, calm, but still have an air of absolute confidence, and this is how this has to be, and not be ashamed and not be, not give them any hint that you are not, you don't have an understanding of what you are entitled to or what you want, being specific in what it is you want, then, you know, it makes all the difference in the world. It still makes a difference.
Mm-hmm. It's all in how you present yourself.
Right.
That's wonderful. Well, one last thing I want to talk about, because I'm so excited to hear you, to have you write this down, that one of the things you do for fun is you sing with a blues group. How did that start?
So I've always sung in choirs, and a couple of, and Monday nights were the choir night, and it was from 7 to 9, and it was just strictly that I live a good hour away, and the choir was in Williamsport, and it was just, I was just getting home late, 10 o'clock or so, so I knew I wanted to back away from that, and a friend of mine said, hey, there's this music school in Williamsport called the Uptown Music Collective, and my daughter goes there, but I think they have an adult group. You should check the website. So indeed, I went to the website, and they had something called the Adult Blues Work Group, and you paid the $30 a month tuition, and I think, okay, I'm signing up for a class. That's fine. It's only an hour. That'll be perfect. You can go, and you can learn about the blues, and you can do some singing or, you know, I've always had this interest in music, and that'll sort of appease that side, and you know, it also gives me something that's not work, that I can do outside of the home. And literally the second week I was there, they said, well, so the gig we have next month, and I went, gig? Wait a minute. what are you talking about? And they're like, oh well, yeah, you know, and it was so
live.
After a month and a half of every week saying, I'm going to quit. I learned three songs, and where I was the lead vocal, and a few others where I was just doing harmony because there was another female vocalist and several male vocalists, and there's four guitars, a bass player, a drummer. And so I drank a very large coffee mug, one of those travel mugs of wine, and it was the night before the last year's election. And where else did you want to be the night before last year's election? And down at the Bullfrog in Williamsport was my first show, and I didn't die, and I know what I survived, and I discovered now several shows into it and several songs that that night I discovered it was the most fun I could ever have. It was an incredible stress relief. It was it was just a ridiculous amount of fun once I got past my nerves. And now we just had a show last night and it at the Bullfrog again. Fun. Very, you know, I don't have the same amount of nerves. People were dancing, people were singing along, clapping. I did, you know, you discovered some truism, like I understand how, you know, the whole idea of drinking too much before a show, that's where now I see why they get into those drugs and alcohol things problems. And then when you're done, you're really wide awake. Like I was wide awake until about 2 in the morning. But it's different. And the people there, we just talk music. We just talk about music. There's no work. There's no politics. There's no community. It's strictly about what are we going to sing? What are we going to play? Are you doing this? It's 1 hour of 100% music. Nothing else enters into it. And the performances are, you know, you show up half an hour before, you do it, and, you know, you go home. And if you're lucky, the restaurant for free. And that's about it. But it's been a real, it's an incredible stress reliever and more fun than I've ever had in my life.
All right. So will you be auditioning for The Voice?
No. Not looking to change careers anytime soon.
Okay.
Not looking to, you know, it's strictly just, you know, and it's funny because the school has all these high schoolers, and some things they'll do, they'll, you know, put one of the other groups on and then us. And so we'll always say, okay, you just saw that group. Now think you've time traveled 40 years and look at the same people, look at us, and this is now what they're going to sign up. But
all
it's just,
right.
It's fun.
Oh, I think it's
Thank you.
Wonderful. I think it's great.
Great.
I don't know. How did you it just became something you were singing in the choir, and then you decided that was too far away, but then isn't this place the same distance?
What was the time commitment? So the choir was 2 hours and then on Monday nights, and then when they did a performance, it was 2 hours on Monday, 2 hours on Friday, 2 hours Saturday morning, then 3 hours on Sunday, where this is like show up half an hour before the performance. It was really the time commitment and more than anything else. But this, you know, the music's a little bit more accessible. Some of it I know, some of it's new. But yeah, I mean, who doesn't want to be singing, you know, I'm trying to think of, I'm blanking
anything.
On one of my songs, but anything
yeah, I mean, is singing is good.
Clearwater or Rolling Stones or a funny song called 29 Ways. It's sort of risque and, you know, it's fun. It's a taking, and the time commitment, you know, we probably perform about 6 times a year. So it's not, you know, it's not too much and it works.
That's wonderful. I think that is one of the best stories I ever heard. That's just so good. It's just, it's the kind of thing that makes you feel like, you know, you have all these doubts and you second guess everything. Oh, well, that'd be fun, but, and you fill it in with all the other stuff. But it's just taking a leap of faith into something like that, that is just so rewarding. And it's just, it's great. I love that you are attorney by day and a songstress at night.
Occasionally, yeah. I'm a mom and a wife and many other things at night. But yeah, but then occasionally this other side comes out and it's fun. That's all I can say.
Well,
it's a blast.
That is wonderful. And on that note, I'm going to wrap it up here and say thanks to my guest, attorney Kim Manning. And to all of you in my Power of the Purse community, I hope today's podcast was helpful in enriching your understanding of money and how it can help you achieve your life goals. If you'd like to spend 15 minutes on a call with me and ask me questions about your personal finances, please go to my website, powerofthepursepodcast.com, select the contact tab, and find a time that works for you. And thanks again, Attorney Kim Manning, for sharing your time and your knowledge. And how can people reach you if they have some questions?
Certainly, they can email me at my personal email address, which is KM Manning, so KMMANNING at epix.net.
Wonderful. And until the next time, thanks for listening. And remember, money is not the enemy. Your ignorance of it is. Goodbye.
Thanks again, and join us next time to explore more ways you can take control of your finances and your life.